I'm Stephen Hunley from IUPUI, and this is Leading Improvements in Higher Education, a service of the Assessment Institute in Indianapolis. Our sponsor for this season is Watermark, the largest global provider of educational intelligence software solutions for higher education. This episode discusses technology's role in supporting assessment-related activities and features a representative from our podcast sponsor. We are pleased to welcome Austin Adair, Vice President, Sales Enablement at Watermark. Two colleagues representing Watermark client institutions join Austin for this episode, Michelle Atkins and Royce Robertson. Michelle is Assistant Provost for Accreditation and Research and Professor of Education at Union University. Royce is Director of Instructional Design and Academic Technology at Lemoyne College. I hope you enjoy our time with Austin, Michelle, and Royce on this episode of Leading Improvements in Higher Education. We have Michelle, Royce, and Austin with us today on a Watermark-centric episode of Leading Improvements in Higher Education. And I'm so delighted to welcome our guests. Michelle, Royce, Austin, welcome to the program.
Hi, Stephen. It's great to be here.
Hi, Stephen. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Hey, Stephen. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks, Austin, to you and to our friends at Watermark and to Royce and Michelle. Welcome. We're certainly glad you're with us today. Let's begin as we get started. We'd like to learn a little bit about each of you as individuals and professionals. We'd like to ask you to tell us briefly about your career, including what you do in your current role. For this question, we'll first come to Michelle, followed by Royce, and conclude with Austin. Michelle.
Well, Stephen, it's interesting. I started out in the K-12 public education sector as a special education teacher. And then I moved to the district level administration. And at first I thought, you know, that's an interesting way to start out in higher education. But when I reflect upon it, you know, what perfect way to start in assessment, because the special education, I really learned about, you know, what it's the nuts and bolts, I guess, if you will, about looking at student learning. And then, you know, I never, ever intended to come into higher education. And that's what's so funny about it all is that one day I was talking to a mentor, my mentor from my college days, about, you know what, I've got to write this dissertation thing. And, you know, this supervisory role is getting a little much. And so what could I do while I'm writing my dissertation? And before I got back to my office, I had a call, a voicemail on my phone from the dean of the College of Education saying, hey, I'd like to talk to you about your career in higher education. So that's how I actually got into higher education. And since that time, I've been here at Union University. This is my 21st year. Time does fly when you're having fun, right? So, and I now serve as the Assistant Provost for Accreditation and Research. But before that time, I was a education professor and educational research professor. I do moonlight as a school psychologist. So I guess I've been in assessment this my whole career, really. But in my role as assistant provost, I am the SAC COC accreditation liaison. And I also support programmatic accreditation processes across the institution. We have quite a few for our institutional size, but I'm responsible for institutional effectiveness, institutional research, the institutional review board. I often joke that if it has the word institutional in it, that is my role, right? And then I still hold faculty status and teach in the College of Education. So I guess that is me in a nutshell.
Michelle, thanks for that introduction, the importance of mentors in one's professional development and pathways. And you mentioned SACS COC in your description of your role. And for our listeners who may not be aware of that particular organization, would you mind briefly providing just a bit of context to what they do? Michelle.
Oh, sure. The SAC-COC stands for the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools Commission on Colleges, and they're one of the institutional accreditors in the United States. So they it's a peer-reviewed accreditation association, which really provides some outstanding also professional development. I'm very fortunate to serve on the Board of Trustees for SAC-COC, and actually it's where I gain a lot of our professional development, not only the Assessment Institute, I'll play that for IUPUI, but SAC-COC provides a lot of professional development, not just a peer review evaluation, if you will, system, but also a lot of professional growth. So I challenge all of our listeners here on the podcast to get involved in the peer review process.
Michelle Adkins, thank you again for that introduction and that context for SAC-COC. And of course, the great shout out about the Assessment Institute. Let's now come to Royce Robertson to learn about his career. Royce.
Thank you. A little bit about myself. I guess I consider myself an unapologetic generalist. I've worked in a variety of capacities in both higher education and in K-12 education. Usually around topics involving teaching and learning, assessment, and technology. And I've had a few titles in my career, and I've had a few stops at different places. And I think I've never really been concerned with the title just so long as I get to play with those three moving parts, the teaching and learning, assessment, and technology. That love, that passion, that convergence has brought me to my current position as the Director of Instructional Design and Academic Technology at Lemoyne College in Syracuse, New York, up in upstate or central New York, Finger Lakes region. Next week is my 7-year anniversary of being at Lemoyne, and I've been in higher education now for about 22 years. I oversee a team of three people. One instructional designer and two instructional technologists. And we essentially support the technological needs of the faculty in terms of assessment and instruction, virtual courses. We don't do any work with the physical classroom itself, but focus mostly on faculty support of the tools that they use to do their work in instruction and assessment. Prior to that, I've held positions as a director of assessment at a large, fully online institution where I worked with all corners of the institution to help successfully achieve national and specialty accreditations. And prior to that, I was an assistant professor at a regional university in the Northeast. And prior to that, I had a career in K-12 as a teacher and administrator. For me, I think the things that I enjoy the most about the work that I do are the problem-solving aspects of it, the relationship building with faculty and those that work every day in making good assessment work, and to be able to identify something that the institution needs to accomplish, be it an accreditation or some kind of successful project that is rooted in continuous improvement, and then get engaged in that process. That's what really excites me in my work. When I'm not working, I usually am a big fan of spy and intrigue novels. I like to ride my road bike, affectionately known as Sparky or Cranky, and I enjoy spending time with my wife and daughter.
Royce, thank you for that introduction. And, you know, Austin Adair, as you've heard about Royce's background and Michelle's background, they have a lot of great practitioner and collegiate experience in the work that they do and also K-12 experience. And Royce was mentioning three concepts that I think are probably near and dear to your heart: teaching and learning, assessment, and technology. So Austin, tell us about your career, including what you do in your current role.
Sure, Stephen. Well, before I came to Watermark, I completed my graduate program in instructional communication and assessment at Texas State University in San Marcos. And while I was there, I taught the basic communication course to mostly freshmen and absolutely loved teaching interpersonal communication and public speaking. I really loved teaching so much. And while I was there, I got connected with the then president of TK20, which was one of the original companies that formed Watermark, and started working on their implementation team weeks after we first met. So it was really kismet. And I have been with Watermark now over 9 years. It was 9 years in January. Time flies. And I've pretty much worked in every single team, including implementation, support, sales. And now I serve as the vice president of sales enablement. And in that role, I lead training and development efforts for our client-facing teams to help them understand and engage with the institutional effectiveness framework and really empower them to consult on best practices in assessment and in continuous improvement. So I'm still getting my teaching fix here at Watermark, but with a slightly different student population.
Austin, thank you for that introduction. And let me just continue with you. You have acknowledged Watermark and some of the work that you do there. And as we begin our conversation, we'd like to learn a little more about how you would describe Watermark. What is the purpose of Watermark? What are some of the solutions that you offer your higher education clients? Austin.
Sure. At the core, at Watermark, we really believe that insights inspire progress. For many years, we've partnered with higher ed institutions to help streamline various facets of their institutional effectiveness framework, including outcomes assessment, direct assessment of student learning, accreditation reporting, course evaluations, faculty credentialing and activity reporting, promotion and tenure processes, and ultimately course catalog and curriculum management. And our goal here has really been to connect those historically disparate and disjointed data collection efforts and empower administrators, faculty, and staff to realize a continuous improvement process that transcends beyond purely compliance-based strategies. Sometimes assessment can get a bad rap just because it can feel like checking a box, but it's more than that. And throughout this whole journey, working with Watermark, it's been a labor of love. And I personally feel like I found my tribe here and feel very fortunate to be on this amazing team, which has largely come directly from higher ed.
Austin, thank you. And this would probably be a good time to remind our listeners they can learn more about Watermark at watermarkinsights.com. I'd like to also come back to Royce and Michelle, and we'd likewise like to learn from you a little bit about each of your institutions. Royce, we'll start with you, followed by Michelle. So Royce, tell us about your campus's mission, the types of students you serve, and maybe some interesting facts you'd like us to know. Royce.
Yeah, as I mentioned before, I'm at Lemoyne College, which is in Syracuse, New York. Lemoyne is a Jesuit Catholic institution. Our mission primarily focuses on the fulfillment of those Ignatian or Jesuit components, such as cura personalis, care for the whole person, or the concept of men and women for and with others. There are many rich traditions within the Jesuit tradition, and really the institution, I believe, does a great job of trying to bring those traditions to life every day in achievement of that mission. There's about 3,100 undergraduate students at Lemoyne, about 500 graduate. We have programs that range from the arts and sciences to occupational therapy to physician's assistant, and we have a recently launched EDD program in executive leadership. A couple of fun facts about Lemoyne: it's the youngest of the American Jesuit institutions. It was founded in 1946, and it was the first U.S. Jesuit school chartered co-ed. Which was, I think a big shift for a lot of the Jesuit institutions at that time. They started all male. And our current president, Linda Lemire, a wonderful woman. She is the first full-time lay female Jesuit president of any institution in the United States. So we also have five of the watermark tools that we use on campus, and I have a significant role in the administration of all of those.
Royce, thanks so much for that information about your institution. And Michelle, likewise, tell us about your context in which you work.
Thank you, Stephen. Well, I am at Union University, and Union is, like Royce, we are affiliated with, we're a faith-based institution. Our mission is to provide Christ-centered education that promotes excellence and character development in service to church and society. So we, our core values are of being Christ-centered and excellence-driven, people-focused, and future-directed. So we are attuned and intentional about character development with our students. Now, we are a small liberal arts university, but I say we're small, but yet we're complex in that we offer from associate's degrees all the way up through doctoral degrees. We have a College of Pharmacy, College of Nursing. We have, so we offer the PharmD, the EDD, and we also have a Doctor of Nursing Practice. We have approximately like 1,300 undergraduate students that are traditional undergraduate students, and they're mainly residential students. And we also have about 1,000 non-traditional commuting students and about 1,000 graduate students in there. So it's quite small and quite diverse. We have our main campus here in Jackson, but we also have satellite campuses just north of Nashville, two in Memphis, one we just acquired, more inner city Memphis to serve the urban Memphis community. There's some fun facts about Union. One is that Bear Bryant, famous Bear Bryant, his very first coaching job was at Union University. He was an assistant football coach. And what's interesting about that is now Union no longer has a football team. So, you know, we have T-shirts, I think, that says Union University undefeated since 1936 or something like that, because he was our coach in 1936. Another fun fact, Royce was talking about they're the youngest institution in the Jesuit. We are the oldest Southern Baptist institution in the United States. So we were founded in 1823. So in 2023, we will celebrate our bicentennial anniversary. So we're really looking forward to that.
Michelle, thank you for that introduction. And as you're describing Union University, and Royce is likewise describing Lemoyne College, what I note is both of your institutions, I should say, are really focused on the holistic development of learners. And Austin, let's transition to you and talk about how you and your colleagues at Watermark help support the holistic development of learners. What are some hallmarks of institutions that you've worked with that have a good understanding of implementation of technology solutions to support accreditation, assessment, and student success? Austin.
Great question, Stephen. I would say personally, hands down, that the most significant predictors of success in using technology to support this holistic learning are strong leadership and a strong success framework. So we're really in fabulous company here. I've had the great pleasure of working with hundreds of institutions directly, and the most successful are always those that have skilled, enigmatic captains that are steering the ship. I've always felt like there is this notion that technology might just be the silver bullet. It's magically going to fix a process that can seem broken. And that really isn't the case. Educational technology is designed to enhance and streamline an institution's process. And at the core, developing that solid framework of institutional effectiveness is crucial. But more than that, charismatic leadership is needed to bring that framework to life and engage all of the campus stakeholders in that continuous improvement process. So, you know, from my perspective, I've seen really great IE leaders, first and foremost, are data gurus. They can synthesize massive data sets and create meaning from a variety of inputs that come from what seem like all over the place. But they're also really great cheerleaders for the institution. Not all faculty are statisticians, so empowering them to understand data and make it actionable is crucial to student success. And tapping into that affective domain to make assessment transformational is what I believe is truly indicative of solid leadership.
Austin, thank you for that overview. And you provide a very unique vantage point, having in the context of working with so many institutions and colleagues across the country and indeed around the world. And you mentioned, of course, strong leadership and a strong success framework as important ingredients to complement the technologies that are used. So, Michelle, let's come back to you first, followed by Royce, to maybe build on what Austin is describing. How have you developed, or how are you continuing to develop, a culture around accreditation, assessment, and student success? Michelle.
Thank you, Stephen. And I'm going to try to be brief on this because I think I could talk the whole podcast on this, this particular point. When I walked into the specific role I'm in now, I think it's been 8 years now, it was evident to me that we had a culture of compliance. I say that because of the comments that I heard, mainly as just tell me what I have to do to check the box for our accreditor. Just tell me what I have to do. And that was just unacceptable. So I just want to pinpoint, I've worked very hard and we're evolving. We're ever changing. We haven't arrived. But there are three C's that I want to just briefly touch on that we're doing here at Union to try to create that culture of student success, of excellence. And one is commitment, it is communication and ease of effort, and collaboration. Commitment, by what we did is we created an assessment day. Now, we want to assess all the time now, but what we were finding is we had low response rates on things that we were asking students to do. So what I'm talking about, national surveys, those kind of things. And so therefore, we just weren't using any results. We were asking people to do things and then we weren't using them for anything. So it was just a waste of time. So our administration committed to create, and our faculty created, committed to a day each semester that was two-pronged. One was we were going to not have class that day, but yet students were expected to be there. Now, we take attendance at our institution, so students are expected to be at assessment day, and our response rate for these assessments went up from, let's say, 20% to 99%. So that's one thing. We do this in the fall and in the spring. And then in the afternoons, we have time where our departments can get together and discuss assessments and discuss student learning. And then that's helped to create our culture. The second thing is communication and ease of effort. I changed our institutional effectiveness cycle from one of a three-year cycle to that of an annual cycle. And but when I did so, we have just communicated, communicate. I say, when you think you have communicated enough to your faculty and staff, communicate one more time. And communicate in multiple ways. For instance, I meet with stakeholders in large groups. Then I email stakeholders pertinent information. I engage in phone conversations. I provide written documentation to people. I meet one-on-one with department heads. And I am an office of one, by the way. I have no staff. It's just me. But you have to take that time to communicate. You have to communicate that what we are doing here to create this culture of student success and a culture of assessment is actually going to ease their burden, not add to their burden, because I believe in this culture of compliance. They truly believe that it's one more thing I have to do. If somehow you communicate that the culture of assessment is easing their burden, okay? And you involve, the more people that you involve in their communication efforts, the better off you are, right? So that's the communication. So we have commitment and communication. And finally, it's collaboration. And I'd like to tell you a story that emphasizes this point. Several years ago, our student life, our academic affairs area, business office, we all came together and developed this three-prong approach because we saw that we were losing students to academic failures, if you will. So we'll just call it academic failures. These were students who were, their GPAs were falling below 2.0. And so before we did, at our institution, we were issuing midterm grades. So this would, in a 16-week term, they would issue them at the 9-week period. Well, that's just too late. So students did not have enough time to recover. We were not catching these students in time. So what we did is we used predictive analytics, first of all, to figure out what are the factors that would predict students, that students would get in trouble. What are those factors? And then, so we would catch these students ahead of time. Then we move those midterm grades up to the 6-week point, and we change the name to progress reports. They're not grades, they're just progress reports. And then we created natural contact points. So we have the predictive analytics, we have the progress reports, and then we pinpointed natural contact points. So coaches, academic advisors, residence life staff, people in the lives of these students who already had these natural relationships with students. There's a big difference if I get an email or a text message or a phone call from someone I already know and have a relationship with than if I get one of those types of communications from some stranger at the institution. I am more likely to pick up the phone and talk to someone I have a relationship with about an academic recovery plan. So that's what we were doing in intervening. And we had a resiliency team that would come in and develop a resiliency plan. Now, we did this for that. We also did this for undecided majors and for those who came in with some type of conditional admission status. What we have found, and that we've been doing this about 5 years now, we have found that the retention rate for these students was 30 points lower than our average population. Now it's exactly the same. So it was at 50% before, and now our retention rate is at 85% for this population. So it's gone up, you know, significantly. If I were to put that in a statistical formula, I would think that would be significant, right? For our conditionally admitted students, their retention rate, are you ready for this, is at 92% from freshman to sophomore year. We retain 92% of our conditionally admitted students. So those are just three things that we're doing to create a culture. So we are collaborating with one another instead of in silos. We are communicating and we are committing to putting assessment at the forefront of our minds.
Michelle, thank you for describing the assessment and improvement culture at Union University, including the ingredients, as you were mentioning, of commitment, communication, and collaboration. Royce, let's learn from you about how Lemoyne College is likewise developing and improving this culture.
I'd have to say that there are still some pockets of that compliance mindset, as mentioned. And I think long before the pandemic, I think some of us were talking about we need to flatten the curve. And by that, I mean, imagine, you know, faculty members or the college as a whole on a roller coaster, and they're going for a ride, and that ride is called accreditation. And at certain points in that ride, they're down in the valley of the roller coaster, and it's kind of, you know, it's not as scary as it is at the top of the roller coaster. And they're like, oh, good, that drop is over. and they kind of cruise down at the bottom, and then it starts to tick its way back up the roller coaster. And as they get to the top of the crest of it and they look down over that big drop that it's about to do, you know, like right before the accreditation visit, we were getting caught up in the curves. We were, you know, we're spending a lot of time wishing that we were back in that kind of easy rolling low spot of the roller coaster. So culturally, we're moving away from that compliance mindset, pocket by pocket, department by department. And we're starting to realize that that assessment is one of those daily activities, weekly, monthly, that needs to be part of the everyday fabric of the institution. And like Austin said, it starts with great leadership. And I don't take any credit for it at all. I'll talk about my role in a minute. But Jim Hannon, our interim provost, and Kara Evans, our director of student learning assessment, deserve much of the credit for their, you know, their persistence and their good ideas and in keeping things moving. Most of my role is to work with my team on the technology component, but we really take a servant leadership approach to it. We kind of consider ourselves the mountain Sherpas. You know, if you're familiar with the tasks of a mountain Sherpa, they hike right along with the person climbing the mountain. They're there for good advice and comfort and, you know, and cooking meals and telling stories and things like that. They don't phone it in from the base of the mountain and say, how's it going up there? You know, my team is usually right in with individual faculty members, program directors, those kind of things, trying to figure out how to implement the tools, writing rubrics, tagging those rubrics and so on. So we do a lot more of the hands-on activities with faculty members that are engaged in assessment. What we focus the most on is using the tools to try to find efficiency and maturity. If you're familiar with the concept of process maturity, like Austin mentioned, he said that the second item was a success framework. For us, we really look at maturation as that success framework, you know, moving from something that was originally ad hoc, where you did it different every time, to then getting it down on paper, describing what it is you do and putting it down on paper. And then after you've put it on paper, you implement it the way you said you, the way you put it on paper. And then you do that over and over again, and you start learning from what you're doing. So, you know, our success framework for my team is maturity, and we want to try to help individuals mature what they're doing, move it from that ad hoc to that optimized. Some examples of some things that we've done around using the tools to help find efficiency and maturity. Our education program transitioned from one accreditor to another. They were clearly and intentionally seeking a way of collecting student work and scoring it, reporting on it. But there was also a savvy faculty member in the department who said, we don't want to have to do separate assessment processes for the accreditor versus the institution versus the state. And we'd really like to be able to reuse a lot of the data and a lot of the reports that we collect and we work on without having to treat our local assessment processes and our national or state accreditation processes as separate. We want to be able to get them to be more in harmony, get those Venn diagram circles to overlap a little more. So we adopted an e-portfolio and we started to use the tagged rubrics within those. And it provided a degree of semantic intelligence to say, here's how we're doing on this standard based on all these different rubric rows that are tagged with that standard. So now that education department, they're starting to see some of the fruits of their labor in that they produce one report and they can use it many different ways. And for them, that's part of that efficiency and that maturity, because then they're not running around trying to create separate handmade reports for every single need and purpose. They're starting to work smarter, not harder. We also have our core curriculum. The folks that were involved in that, they're starting to retire this long-used, very cultural tradition, paper-based system of a lot of rescoring and moving information from one place to another manually by adding some really low overhead tools that allow faculty to quickly score student work. And then that work is already aligned with the core curriculum goals. So once reports are then produced, they actually spend more time discussing the data and proposing actions and spending a lot more time working on the things that matter more to their everyday interaction with students, as opposed to just burning cycles on shuffling paper. So in many regards, some of the work that's at Lemoyne right now is focusing on refining those systems and finding that efficiency and maturity through just doing smarter work.
Royce, thank you. You're describing the importance of efficiency and maturity, also acknowledging that you support colleagues on their assessment journey to make this work, quote, part of the fabric of the institution. Austin, we've been hearing in the answers to the previous questions a lot of the conditions necessary to support institutions, and a lot of these conditions are very people-centric. Let's now turn our attention to some of the innovative uses of technology platforms, including Watermark's suite of solutions that are helping institutions meet their needs. Tell us some of the success stories that you're aware of, and also, what are some challenges institutions typically face in using technology platforms? Austin.
Thanks, Stephen. In terms of innovation, I think what's been most exciting, at least from my perspective, is the desire from the institutional administrators that we work with to make the assessment and data-driven decision-making process easier for faculty. I'll be very candid with you. The original assessment technology platforms that were developed in the early 2000s were primarily designed for administrators, almost exclusively, to have greater visibility into the institutional process. But at that time, faculty were still tasked with duplicating efforts and responding to multiple data requests. So as technology has evolved, we've made great strides in leveraging integrations with not only student information systems, but also with learning management systems as well, to cut down on the time that faculty spend just compiling data, let alone deciphering what all of those data mean. So there's been a big drive to engage faculty and other key campus stakeholders, including academic support offices, to really look at a bottom-up model. So we've seen a lot of really great success from our institutions who have taken advantage of their learning technologies that they have on campus. So we've developed these integrations with LMS platforms. So when we think about measuring direct evidence of student learning, tapping right into the LMS and associating that with the assessment plan, so you can analyze those results in real time rather than have faculty duplicate those efforts, export all of the data, and then send it up the chain in a manual process. We've also looked to explore other ways how we can make this process easier for faculty. So within the context of program review, as an example, there can be a lot of duplication of effort in terms of looking back at prior annual reports in relation to assessment and looking at trends from year to year. And we've really aimed to make that process a lot easier by integrating those reports directly into the program review framework and focusing more time on reflection and less time on the data collection effort. And we really hope that this has been an empowering move so that we're engaging the folks that really can make the most impact based on the actions and reflections that they make. In regard to challenges, one interesting thing that I've seen is this desire to replicate the exact same manual process, but in a technology platform. And I think this relates directly back to what Royce mentioned in terms of the maturation process. While it may seem really easy to translate what currently exists on paper into a digital format, I think there's always room to improve here and think about other ways that we can see a holistic view at what student success looks like. And I'll give you a really good example here. So I've noticed that sometimes there can be this implicit bias towards collecting primarily direct evidence of student learning. And don't get me wrong, direct evidence of student learning is absolutely crucial to student success. But looking at those direct measures only shows you one facet of student learning. So as an example, if I, from my perspective, at least in experience in teaching public speaking, I may assign two public speaking assignments, one informative and one persuasive. And from a data perspective, it can look like we met the outcome. 80% of my students achieved a 3 or higher on the rubric that we leveraged. However, one thing that I did as a lecturer when teaching that basic communication course was add in questions on our course evaluation instrument that was focused on those course learning outcomes to really assess how confident students were in demonstrating those skills or, you know, flexing the new knowledge that they have after taking that course. And one thing that I found was ultimately, they had really low confidence in terms of demonstrating their public speaking skills. So while on paper, it looked like the oral communication outcome was met, there was this other facet that we were missing in terms of ensuring that students felt really confident to demonstrate those behaviors after that course was done. So when implementing technology, I think there's always room to focus on that maturity of assessment and look at multiple facets and multiple measures so that you really have a holistic view of what student success and student performance looks like and still have the ability to create some meaningful action, even when the outcome was met.
Austin, thank you for sharing some of your ideas around technology platforms, including their uses and some challenges and successes. And you were noting over time, we've evolved to more user-friendly technologies, integration and reflection as key components, and of course, using both direct and indirect evidence of student learning. Royce, let's come to you, followed by Michelle, to learn more about how you're using technology platforms to advance your work. What has worked well and where have there been challenges? Royce.
Currently, we're working on a few different projects within faculty credentialing, rank and tenure process, e-portfolios, and general education assessment. And if I were to look across all of those, I would say that first and foremost, the faculty involvement in the process itself, in the decision making, is paramount. That is the variable for us, and the one thing that we're always trying to imagine new ways to maintain and increase, especially in the midst of a pandemic. So many faculty members and employees of the institution are trying to figure out how to do their work every day, and having, even though some of these responsibilities that they've had in prior years, they can anticipate that they're going to occur, finding the time to fit them in just simply because of the added workload of the pandemic has been difficult. But I'll talk more about pandemic-related things in the future. What's working well for us is that, again, we have a simple focus, and that's on maturity and efficiency. You know, we want to try to save time where we can, work smarter, not harder. And we want to be able to mature the system in a way that we're getting past just describing it and repeating it. And we're actually starting to use the information we gain from the system in order to improve. Most importantly, we're focusing a lot right now in using the technology to implement a process as quickly, efficiently as we can, so that we can spend more time on that data, the discussion, and the action. Like Austin mentioned, that reflective component Because ultimately, when we can get to a point where we can start to advocate for the student is really where we're starting to make the most of the systems that we've built. We are all here for the students. And that is that's why we need to move efficiently through the process in order to get to those fruits, those actions. Some of the challenges that we're facing, as mentioned before, is that building capacity by giving up old or clunky process, you know, continuing to do things the way we've always done them, or just simply translating, like Austin said, that manual process into a technological world. We're also challenged sometimes by not wanting to spend time on some of those logical increments of action. In other words, building momentum by taking on some smaller steps. We get momentum by doing smaller things that improve the system. And then that gives us time and energy and insight to be able to then see and attack some of the bigger ticket items within the system or some of the bigger initiatives and problems. And I think sometimes we get caught up in that inertia of wanting to go right to the big ticket item. Like, we've got to build a new building, or we've got to hire a new faculty member, or we've got to create 16 new courses, and, you know, and not sometimes checking out the middle ground of those actions and trying to see what might help us at least move the needle or point the energy in the right direction. And then the last one is that improving our systems so that we can get faster disaggregation by student groups in order to see where we can make better pockets of improvement. The Jesuit mission focuses on the margins and trying to identify who the marginalized are. And without the ability to quickly disaggregate within our technological platforms, it makes it difficult for us to pinpoint the students who might need the most support the quickest.
Royce, thank you for sharing some of your successes and challenges. And you note data, discussion, and action, all informed by faculty involvement in decision-making. And Michelle, talk to us about some of your uses of technology platforms in your context. Michelle.
Yes, thank you. A couple of years ago, we changed our LMS system over to Canvas. And at that same time, we thought it was a great time to adopt Evaluation Kit, which was one of the best things that we have done, because our faculty have just, you know, clung to Evaluation Kit. At that same time, we made a decision, because believe it or not, we were not evaluating every course every time it was taught. So simultaneously with adopting Evaluation Kit, we passed a policy that we would evaluate every course. At that time, right before Evaluation Kit, our response rate to our course evaluations was hovering around 30%. So I think this was a theme at our institution. We were having trouble with response rates. But so what has worked well with Evaluation Kit is our response rates. You know, Evaluation Kit works so well, integrates well with Canvas. And so our response rates have gone through the roof, and our faculty members and department chairs and deans are actually getting some great information through our course evaluations and using that to improve pedagogy and to improve student learning. So that has worked so well. We are also, one of our big projects now is to launch planning and self-study through Watermark. And so I've finished training everyone right now. And one of my, I'm pleasantly surprised at how our academic support staff have just really embraced planning and self-study and have been excited about the assessment process, whereas in the past, they seemed confused about assessment all the time. Now they are my champions for assessment and have actually motivated our academic programs and the assessment process. So that has worked very well. Assessment leaders have praised, and I am sounds like I am giving a good advertisement for planning and self-study, and I am, because they have praised the intuitive and user-friendly nature of the assessment component of student learning outcomes. And they didn't complain about doing going to annual assessment reports. So that has just really worked well for me. There is a bit of an air of excitement about assessment, which again, it's been a, for me, I tend to be a positive person, but I was reluctant. So this has been a pleasant surprise for me. Now, there have been challenges in the process. One is that, as Royce, I think, mentioned, change is hard and people like their old ways. And so, you know, you do have to be a cheerleader throughout this process. And because none of us like change. And so one thing that we, and this was my mistake, I guess, going into the process, is that, you know, you have to really be cognizant of your data that's in your system now. And I didn't realize that we needed to clean up a lot of things in our SIS before we implemented technology, and especially the system before that. We were with TK20 before that, and that was a garbage in our student information system. And so that was quite a challenge for us. We had to halt things for a while so that we could go back and clean up some things. But, you know, in the end, that was really a blessing, because that should have been done a long time ago. So in the end, of course, a challenge is always, for me, a lack of personnel. But again, I'll go back to, you need to have other champions in your areas. As I said, I'm an office of one, so I would always like to have more time and more personnel in my office. That will always be a challenge, you know, when you're implementing anything. But, you know, and the overall technology has been key in helping us in the process. Again, we're not there yet in changing our culture, but it has been a key in helping us move in the right direction and changing our culture around here to a culture of assessment.
Michelle, thank you for talking about technology's role in supporting your culture of assessment. Well, in Royce's prior remarks, he mentioned previewing some answers around COVID-19. So Austin, let's come to you and learn about how institutions have been leveraging technology platforms to address the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. And we should acknowledge, at the time of this recording of this episode, we're slowly starting to turn the corner we hope, coming out of the pandemic. But Austin, what are you hearing from your clients in terms of how they have adapted their work, especially during this last year? Austin.
Well, Stephen, there is no denying that this past year has been incredibly difficult for everyone. And for higher ed, you know, without relying on our typical face-to-face trainings and standard office visits, we've really seen more of a direct need to leverage solutions that are intuitive and easy to navigate. And as a result, Watermark has really doubled down on our focus on integration and other streamlined work flows for faculty and administrators. Michelle, I'm so appreciative to hear the feedback from your team regarding planning and self-study and how the easy guided process to navigate assessment has helped. In another example, within our faculty accomplishments and reporting system, we used to rely heavily on manual data entry. So as faculty would publish new scholarship, they would really need to manually enter each and every update that they would typically just do on their CV. So as a result, we developed a new CV import tool for them to simply upload a PDF of their current CV and get those accomplishments into the system in 80% less time. So I think overall, we've seen more of a drive to adopt technology and, again, really direct faculty to spend the majority of their time teaching and reflecting, and less time on, again, those compliance seeking strategies. So I think it's been really empowering to move beyond the status quo and what can sometimes seem like that heavily manual process that you're stuck in, and brainstorm new ways to function in a more virtual environment.
Austin's describing integration and streamlining as key responses, if you will, a more perhaps more accelerated responses during the past year. Michelle, let's come to you, followed by Royce, to get a brief understanding of some of your COVID-19 responses from your institution. Michelle.
Sure, Stephen. You know, our traditional undergraduate students here are very much face-to-face. We're residential face-to-face, whereas our adult and graduate studies are online primarily. So when the pandemic hit, it was a shock to our professors and students. But what we learned through that is that now, well, and we went back face-to-face in fall of 2020. Okay, so we were back with safety precautions. But what we learned is that our professors, first of all, quickly learned things like Zoom and Canvas. Okay, they quickly learned that. And today, they are still integrating those in their face-to-face classes as supplemental learning tools. So they learned, and we learned that technology is a wonderful learning tool through the process. So bad things can yield good results.
Michelle, thank you for those examples. And Royce, likewise, how has your institution been responding to and adapting to COVID-19?
Like many other institutions, we've got a litany of things that we've done, and I can't list them all, and I certainly didn't have involvement in all of them, but I'll focus specifically on something that my team did. I think about mid-March, early March last year, and we got together and we were faced with a lot of the kind of scenarios that Michelle just described, faculty members who didn't have experience with certain tools and such. And we really put our heads around the problem and said, how are we going to attack this? And what we came up with, I don't know if there's a scholarly base behind this, and if there is, some listener will probably someday come back and say, here's the article that explains it all. But what we came up with was actually an acronym called TEAM. And this relates to training and support of faculty. And TEAM stands for triage, establish, advance, and maintain. And it didn't matter if we were starting with the basics of Zoom or Canvas or whatever tool, we triaged and we took care of the most important people first. In other words, we wanted to make sure that those that knew the least could gain the most information the quickest. And we would then establish basic skills by offering a routine of workshops to people and a routine of services to be able to help them. And then we would advance or broaden by adding new topics and new ideas and deepening for those that had more kind of advanced approaches or needed some affinity groups, like let's get the stats professors together and talk about what they do. And then maintain is the end of it. And that's where we say, okay, here's all the things that we want to continue doing. And we want to be able to do these on a regular basis so that when we have new adjuncts come on campus, like say in the fall, of last year. They didn't teach in the spring, but they come to us in the fall. Well, we've got to triage them. We've got to establish the basic skills for them. And then we've got to be able to maintain that through the semester so that they too feel supported. So we really grabbed on to the TEAM idea and used that as a means of driving our training and development decisions so that we could live and kind of regrow with each semester.
Royce, thank you. You're describing the TEAM acronym of triage, establish, advance, and maintain, likely something we can adapt post-pandemic. Thanks so much. Let's now learn from each of you some recommendations you have for listeners who use technology platforms. What advice do you have for them? What recommendations? And how can these tools help institutions meet their various needs? For this question, we'll first come to Austin, followed by Royce, and then Michelle. Austin.
My advice here is to just be a really good listener. Meet with your faculty and key stakeholders and listen to what's challenging to them. Technology can certainly help ease the burden of many tasks, but that doesn't mean that it's easy for everyone. Collecting feedback from your teams and implementing that with your technology partners like Watermark can be really empowering for everyone and can certainly help create more buy-in as well.
Austin, thank you. Your advice to listen to stakeholders, that's a recommendation coming from Austin. Royce, what's a recommendation you might offer concerning the use of technology platforms?
If there were a bumper sticker, a hashtag, a t-shirt that had the phrase that my team most commonly repeats when it comes to adopting or selecting new technology, it is goals before tools. We always want to make sure that we have a clear need before we start diving into bells and whistles and really focus on what is it that we want to accomplish before we start talking about the tool itself. If you're a fan of logic models, we'll often work through those and kind of say, well, what is the output here? What is the outcome? What is the impact that we want to have? And then kind of related to that, goals before tools ideas. We want to avoid the bias of the easy button. So many people fall into the shiny object syndrome of if we just get this technology, it'll solve all of our problems. And that just isn't true, because realizing that most change is related to the human beings that are doing the work brings you right back to goals before tools. What is it that we want to accomplish over the bells and whistles of the tools that we're selecting, because ultimately it's people that are going to do the work.
Royce, thank you. So Michelle, we're hearing Austin talk about listening to stakeholders. Royce reminding us that it's important to prioritize goals before tools. What's a piece of recommendation you might have concerning technology platforms? Michelle.
That's great. I had on here very similar to Austin and Royce, because I have begin with the end in mind. But I would add to that, to when you are using platforms, I would say build a broader team. So it's very important when implementing technology, I think, to have champions in the room and to take it slow, take your implementation slow and easy. Don't force change on your faculty and staff without a lot of training and support, and get as many people involved in the process as possible on the front end to show them how easy the process is and how you're going to ease the burden. So I think that I think we're saying the same things here. So
let me stay with you, Michelle, and ask you to consult your crystal ball and look ahead over the next few years, maybe the next 3 to 5 years, and talk to us about some trends you see shaping higher education, especially from your vantage point, including how you and your colleagues might be prepared to address those trends. Michelle.
Yes, well, what I see too is I do see a heightened emphasis on data-informed decision-making, although we've seen that, you know, here, it's here now, but I don't see that ending, and I see it actually continuing to grow. Also, especially in our private school sector with we've seen this in the news headlines, and this rising cost of higher education. But in the private sector, I see the real need to find alternative funding sources for higher education. That's also in the public sector as well. But also, we at our institution see a growing non-traditional or adult student population. We see that for online services as well, but we need some support services for this unique population. They are taking care of children. They're taking care of their parents, and they are also working full time. So we need to find those support services that they need to retain these students in school. And I'll say finally, I think the online learning trend continues and it grows. However, at our institution, especially during the pandemic, we found our 18 through 21 year olds overwhelmingly wanted in-seat courses. So I find this paradox here of we see this growing need for online demand for online courses, but yet our 18 through 21 year olds overwhelmingly demanded face-to-face classes. So I think we at our institution are going to wrestle with this, you know, dichotomy here of, do we offer more online or do we offer more face-to-face classes? So that's something that we are actually currently wrestling with here at Union University.
Michelle, thank you for those future trends. And Royce, likewise, looking ahead, what do you see as major trends and how are you and your colleagues preparing to address those trends? Royce.
You know, there are so many things going on in the country socially, politically, that I think you could you could go a lot of different ways with this. But where my mind goes as someone who is trained in curriculum and instruction and focuses on the work that I do every day, you know, obviously I have some, I try to be a cautious optimist in many cases, but what I see the institution doing in some cases is actually fractionalizing and specializing, where exactly as Michelle had mentioned, there's students that want the traditional experience and then students that want an online experience. We're going to start to see, I believe, the institution start to divide itself in some regards and say this portion of the institution is going to move ahead full steam with these innovative or more ancillary approaches, like you're seeing a rise in changes in delivery methods, like online or competency based, these micro masters programs, but then also catering to their core business for some institutions like Lemoyne, where that traditional 18 to 22 year old campus experience is still a heart of the heart of the campus. So I see things kind of, people within the institution starting to specialize more within the work that they do. That also means that the technology is going to need to be there. For example, institutions that want to scale new programs quickly, they're going to need solid, objective curriculum maps in order to describe and anticipate what programs would look like, so that they're not wasting resources on six different versions of an introductory course. So the technology is going to need to be there to be able to map those programs, to track them, to make sure that, make sure that they're designed efficiently so that there is less waste on the student end, because we know that their consumer behavior is catching up with the rest of the markets, where if they're not getting what they want, they may move on. So what am I doing about it? In my work on campus as a servant leader, trying as best as I can to engage people in those processes, like curriculum mapping, like more mature assessment practices, and really say, okay, if instructional design, if you are looking to take your program and break it up into smaller pieces and make it and offer it to students in different ways, then here's the tools that you need to employ and some of the practices that you need to engage in order to do that. So again, my response is not as visionary. It's more in tune with what I do on campus. And that's a lot of very hands-on practical work with faculty.
Royce, thank you for those future trends. And we heard a cheerleader, I think, in the background. I think your dog was concurring with some of your future trends you were previewing for us. What's your dog's name?
Annabelle. She's a very feisty Maltese Shih Tzu. And believe me, we don't agree on everything.
Well, we're glad Annabelle is the guest star of our podcast today. So Royce, thanks for those future trends. And Austin, you've been hearing Michelle and Royce describe the future. What does your crystal ball reveal, Austin?
I think we're all on the same page here, Stephen. From my perspective, I definitely think the future of higher ed involves more technology and integrated technology at that. As we've designed and brainstormed new ways to work and even teach in a more virtual environment, those integrated technologies are going to become even more critical to driving the academy forward. And ultimately, I think this will allow for more time to focus on improving not only student success, but institutional success as well. And certainly at Watermark, we're committed to that integrated effort as much as we can.
Austin, thank you. As we draw our time together to a close, I'd like to ask each of you to leave with our listeners a brief final thought. Royce, we'll start with you, followed by Michelle, and conclude with Austin. Royce.
I think it's been mentioned already, but build your skills as a listener. There's so much going on right now, and we are often focused on our kind of our own perspective and the things that we need to get done each day, and getting our opinion across to those who might be listening to us, and be mindful enough to stop and listen and really try to put yourself in the shoes of the person that you're assisting or serving, or who is coming to you with a need.
Royce Robertson, thank you very much for that final thought. Michelle Atkins, to you.
Thank you, Stephen. I want to speak to all the listeners like me who are flying solo in your office of one. You're not really flying solo if you tear down the silos. So find the student success champions across campus. They are the assessment champions. So build your team from diverse areas and collaborate. So when I think of my work this way, I have an office of many. Thank you.
Michelle, thank you. And finally to Austin for your final thought.
Thank you, Stephen. What I would mention to our listeners today is that assessment can be challenging, but like Michelle mentioned, you are not alone in this effort at all. It takes a village to make an institution succeed and push forward. And I really would like to take this time to thank both Royce and Michelle and their respective teams for being such fabulous partners and exemplars of stellar leadership. As a true assessment nerd, it makes my heart really happy to hear about these thriving cultures of assessment, and really feel fortunate and thankful to join in on this discussion today.
Austin Adair, thank you. And we gratefully acknowledge the support of Watermark as our sponsor for this season of Leading Improvements in Higher Education. I invite listeners to connect with Austin and his colleagues at watermarkinsights.com. We've been speaking with Austin Adair, Royce Robertson, and Michelle Atkins on technology and really the importance of people behind the technology. Michelle, Royce, Austin, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen.
Thanks, Stephen.
This has been Leading Improvements in Higher Education, a service of the Assessment Institute in Indianapolis. Learn more and access other episodes at our website, assessmentinstitute.iupui.edu. Our sponsor for this season is Watermark, the largest global provider of educational intelligence software solutions for higher education. Learn more at watermarkinsights.com. Our podcast producers are Chad Beckner, Caleb Keith, and Shirley Yorger, with original music composed by Caleb Keith. If you know someone who might enjoy the podcast, please encourage them to give us a listen. We appreciate you helping to spread the word. I'm Stephen Hundley from IUPUI, inviting you to join us again for Leading Improvements in Higher Education.